There's one other story that comes to mind. I may have told it here when I was here last time. I'm not sure. John and Tony Lilly invited me to swim with the dolphins. The dolphins are named Joe and Rosie. This was some years back, maybe 5 years ago, 6 years ago. And I went to this tank. They were in a tank in Redwood City. And it was a cold, gray day. This is in California. And I got in my bathing suit. There was no wetsuits. And I was standing by the tank thinking, you sure you want to do this? I mean, why did you want to swim with the dolphins in the first place? You know, it's cold and I'm getting old. And what the hell do I need this for, you know? And so I got into the tank because my friend was already in. And I got into the tank and started to paddle water, whatever you do, tread water. And people were watching to see what Ram Dass was going to do with the dolphins. So whatever I did, I had a smile. I knew that. I mean, that's like, you know, it's all showbiz. So I was smiling, and they went by me very close and very fast, and they were very big. I mean, they were considerably bigger than I'd expected they would be. And I thought, this is their territory, you know, and I really felt like an interloper. And then one of them just hovered right here that was Rosie. And and I reached out and I touched Rosie. All the time my mind is thinking, what do you do with dolphins? See, you touch them, that's nice. I touched them, I assumed the dolphin would swim away, because to me it was a big fish. I mean, you know, I'm not very sophisticated. So I touched it, and it didn't pull away. It was so silky. I had never touched anything like it. I mean, it made silk seem like burlap. It was so incredibly soft. And I started to rub it, and I got into the sensuality of it, and I was just rubbing it. And at one moment, the presence of that being who wasn't going away, I realized that that being was receiving that and was still there. And the intensity of the presence of that being blew my mind, or it took me out of my analytic mind. And I sort of gave up, and I went into ecstasy. I went into that state of, ah. And the minute I did that, within about 2 seconds, Rosie had flipped around. She was upright, pressed against me with her mouth right here, and I was kissing her and hugging her and saying, oh, Rosie, I love you so much. Oh, Rosie, oh, God. And she started to insinuate her body, and I started to get aroused, you see. And I thought, and everybody's watching, see, and I think, you know, is this legal? You know, I mean, it's like, you know. Well, then she went around, came up under my arm, and I wanted to swim with her, and I held the fin, and I went down, and then my hand slipped off, and she came back under, and I did it again, and finally I thought I'd really like to hold her under her belly, but that's coming on a little strong, and I put my arm under her belly, and we started to swim, and she was wild, and I thought it's bugging her, so I let go, and she immediately came under my arm again. She was just going to train me, you know, like... And so finally I said, okay, here we go. And I held on, and we went wildly swimming through the tank. It was, oh, God, it was like a child's fantasy. And then after a while I thought, well, Rosie, this is great for you, but I got to breathe, you know. I mean, it's like, and the minute I thought that, she came to the surface. I mean, it was like the thought just propelled her up. And then we'd go down, and every time I felt the need for breath, she'd come to the surface and wait and then go down. And once I came up, and they were taking photographs, and I got busy hamming it up for the photographer, and I forgot to take a breath. And we went down. I thought, uh-oh, this is where Rosie and I separate, and she came right up again within about 3 seconds. And after about 40 minutes, I was shaking with cold, and I wouldn't let go because it was too great. And she shook me off, went and got Joe, and they nosed me over to the holding platform and forced me out. They decided I had enough. But the part of the story that I really want to tell was that it took me out of my mind, that it helped me get back into my intuitive heart space. And that was a great gift. That was a great teaching for me. Now, I'm learning. all of the spiritual practices that one does primarily are designed to help release you from the tyranny of your own analytic mind. Sometimes you use the mind to beat the mind. Sometimes you do it through devotion. Sometimes you do it through working with energies like breath and so on. The minute you break the identification with your thought, it's as if you come into a quality of awareness that also, besides the quality that it has of presence and clarity about the universe around you, or in you, or you, there is also a quality that is very soft in it. And I focus for that, or I see that as what's called in Chinese the Sin-Sin, H-S-I-N, Sin-Sin, the heart-mind. It's the intuitive heart. It's not the emotional heart. It is like the doorway into that other realm where you are not separate. Like the quality of our emotional heart is like a doorway into that. You notice how with your heart goes out to people. My heart goes out to you is an expression. You give away anything. Take my car, take my house, take it all, the heart says. The mind keeps saying, now, wait a minute. Because the mind is protecting your separateness while the heart is giving it all away, always. And the interesting situation is that we all have these incredibly compassionate hearts that are like, they are the quality of love, the quality of boundaryless, soft, merging presence. But most of us armor our hearts with our mind, with our thought. And the only thing that we're involved in at this moment in our practices then is breaking down that armor so that that intuitive heart can function, because we've cut ourselves off from it by our mind armoring us. And when we do that, we end up feeling starved, because it's through that intuitive heart that we actually get fed by the universe. It's like an umbilical cord of stuff that comes into us. And when we cut it off with the mind, we end up feeling very alienated and very starved. And that's why we're always so greedy. We keep wanting more of everything, because we're always trying to fulfill a hunger in us. And the hunger is created by the way in which we've made ourselves, reinforced our own separateness from it all. And you can see all the pathology in the way we've gotten rid of the extended family, and we've gotten the mobility. We've taught about external freedom, meaning you don't have to be attached to anything. And the cost is incredible. The paradoxes that I've been working with some of them revolve around the issue of suffering and pain. See, most of us, with your mind, because your mind deals with polarities, you feel that if you're happy, you're not sad. And you want to be happy, so you push away that which makes you sad. I've described the image in many lectures of standing in Marin County with a frisbee, about to throw a frisbee. And through my mind went the inscription over Gandhi's tomb, which says, "Think of the poorest person you have ever seen and ask whether your next act will be of any use." See, do you throw the frisbee or don't you? That's the issue of an affluent culture. Can you not throw the frisbee because the fact that a baby's dying every 45 seconds? But if you don't ever throw the frisbee, what is it you're offering the baby? How do you hear how to deal with suffering? And I begun to understand that what is required is that we expand ourselves to embrace all of the planes of consciousness simultaneously for true compassion to arise. If you alter your consciousness sufficiently so that you're standing at the cusp between form and formless, right at the edge, and you look out at form, you are absolutely awed by the beauty, the exquisiteness, the awesome nature of the way in which forms are all related lawfully. Plato refers to that. He talks about seeing the law and praising God as the law. He said, but in order to do that, you can't be identified with your own suffering or your own pleasure, or you don't see it. It's the same thing the Tao says when it says, truth waits for eyes unclouded by longing. If you want something, or if you're pushing something away, you don't see this beauty. It's only when you develop a certain equanimity and a certain emptiness inside, when you're right at the edge of the formless, that you look at the forms and you see the law, and it is so beautiful. I mean, we see it in all these little microcosms. We see it in physics and astronomy. And the way in which a cell structure is related to the way the planets work, and the lawful nature of music and art, and it is... And you look and you see that your own thinking mind is part of that law. And it's all unfolding in a purely lawful way. And then you look and you see that the suffering in the universe, if you stand back far enough, that the suffering is part of the law. There are, from where I'm sitting, when I'm sitting in that place, there are no errors in the universe, not one. That where you are at this moment, with all your tsaras, with all your problems, with all the things of all your if-onlys, just where you are at this moment is the absolutely optimum place you are to be at this moment from a spiritual point of view for your optimum growth. And the statement in you, I should be more like the Buddha or the Christ, or I wish I was there, or I should be meditating more, or all that, that's all part of the perfection. And you look and you see that the way in which suffering works, in the way it works from a spiritual point of view. But then when you identify with your humanness, with your separateness, with your emotional heart, suffering stinks. And when you look at the pain of another human being, it wipes you out because you empathize with it and you feel so horrible about their pain and you would do anything to take it away. And the problem is there's so much of it. I mean, there's battered mothers and battered children and there's starving beings and there's blind people and there's whales that are going extinct and there's seals and there's trees and there's... Where do you begin? You just got to look in a mirror. There's suffering right there. And it's so much for the human heart that the human heart armors itself with the mind, and you become what's known in the service industry, in the caring industry, as professionally warm. You are kind in a way that doesn't hurt your heart. You're caring, like if you're a nurse working in an ICU ward and you're dealing with pain and fear and suffering and death, most of those people become very kind and warm and friendly and caring, but they are protecting. They have cut off their own hearts because they feel they would break otherwise, and they got to save something for home. But if you are going to be free, there's nothing you can turn away from or turn off. And how do you keep your heart open in hell? Becomes the interesting question. the best way I can understand it now is that it is the balancing of these planes of reality inside myself that allows me to do that. Like about a year ago, I was taking care of my stepmother who was dying of cancer, and I was nursing her for the last months of her life. And I watched this process in myself. She had a lot of pain, and I had all the painkillers, and I was all the catheters and all that stuff, and I was doing what I could do to relieve her pain. And as a human being who really loved her a lot, I would have done anything to take away her suffering. But I couldn't do it all. And I had all the appropriate responses of guilt and discomfort and feeling horrible that I couldn't do that. There was another part of me that was watching with absolute wonder as this woman who had had an ego that was so strong, she was so busy being somebody, she was a good person. The pain kept eating away and eating away. There's a quote I may have here, I may not. I guess I don't. Why aren't you here? It's a good quote. But you're not going to hear it tonight, I don't think. There it is. You were lurking. It's by Aeschylus. From the Orestia. In our sleep, pain, which we cannot forget, falls drop by drop upon the heart until, in our own despair, against our will, comes wisdom through the awful grace of God. Comes wisdom through the awful grace of God. What I watched with my stepmother, Phyllis, was that as the pain dropped by drop on her heart, and she kept saying, I don't understand this pain. It's like, I've been a good person. Why am I having this much pain? Why is it so hard to die? I watched that ego finally surrender and this spirit come forth. And the being that I was then with was like... It's like being in the presence of just pure grace. And her death was just absolutely just like ink going into water, just dissolving, just breathing out. And I saw this being who I had never expected to see in our lives together emerge. And I had to admit that it was the pain and the suffering that beat that ego down for this other thing to come through. And I knew I could never have done that to her. And it was the awful grace. It was the awful grace. And what I experience in myself now is that when I'm dealing with somebody, like somebody that just found they have AIDS, and my heart is breaking and we cry together, there's another part of me that is just seeing it all as the unfolding perfection of the universe. That's the new curriculum this person now has. Oh, they're going to learn a lot from this. And at some point, they'll drop their body. It's interesting that as you extricate yourself from your identification with your separateness, your whole feeling about death changes. Because the part of you that isn't separate isn't coming and it isn't going and there's no birth and there's no death. You just are. But because that part of you is not knowable by your mind keeps denying its existence. The part of you that is not in form is only beable. It's not knowable. And the mind goes up the wall trying to figure out how to control that part of you. And for us to stretch to handle what seems like a paradox to the mind, that it's all perfect and it's horrible, that there's nothing to do really, so get on with it. That it is all empty. And when you embrace all of it, you start to embrace the human condition into yourself. You start to embrace the suffering. Like if you live fully in this moment, does this moment include that baby that's taking its last breath from starvation? Yeah. So are you sad? Yes. Does it include the baby taking its first breath as it comes out of its mother's womb? And the joy of the beginning? Yes. So you're happy. If you are the fullness of the moment, all of it, these are all your voices. The cry, there's a beautiful... This won't be so hard to find. Beautiful poem by Thich Nhat Hanh. He's talking about, he says, among other things, I won't read the whole thing. He says, I am the mayfly metamorphizing on the surface of the river. I am also the bird which, when spring comes, arrives in time to eat the mayfly. I am a frog swimming happily in the clear water of a pond. I am also the grass snake who, approaching in silence, feeds itself on the frog. I am the child in Uganda, all skin and bones, my legs as thin as bamboo sticks. I am also the merchant of arms selling deadly weapons to Uganda. I am the 12-year-old girl, refugee on a small boat, who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by a sea pirate. I am also the pirate, my heart not yet capable of seeing and loving. My joy is like spring, so warm it makes flowers bloom in all walks of life. My pain is like a river of tears, so full it fills up all the four oceans. Please call me by my correct names so that I can hear at the same time all my cries and all my laughs, so that I could see that my joy and pain are but one. Please call me by my correct names so that I could become awake, so that the door of my heart be left open, the door of compassion. If you and I are to be free, there is nothing we can push away. And when we die into all of it, and we get out of the egocentric predicament, I should have a better system, shouldn't I? I really feel like a slob. There it is. Next time I'll have it in a computer and I'll push a button and it'll print out. Gandhi. God demands nothing less than complete self-surrender as the price for the only real freedom that is worth having. Meaning you stop being so busy being you. And when a person thus loses herself, she immediately finds herself in the service of all that lives. It becomes her delight and recreation. She is a new person, never weary of spending herself in the service of God's creation. It's interesting that when you have extricated yourself from your own egocentric predicament, and when you have tasted the emptiness of all forms, then your action comes out of the collective quality of the situation, and the suffering of another person is something you do not because I'm helping you, but because it is healing itself. And you're not collecting points for it. You are merely tuning yourself to being part of the harmony of things. You're being part of the way of things. It's like you're dying into the perfection of it all, which includes the beauty of your mind, but it's the servant. It's available, but you are no longer trapped inside of it. It's just the subtlest flip in where you are in relation to who you are. Before you identified with the clouds, now you understand that you are the sky and the clouds. As you extricate yourself from your somebodyness, from your thoughts, which are things, from your body, which is things or stuff, who you are has no time, has no space. It's not here, it's here. Hakuin, the Zen poet, says, "Your coming and going is nowhere but where you are. You're always right here. Where are you going to go?" Ramana Maharshi was dying, the beautiful saint, and all his devotees were crying, "Don't leave us, don't leave us." And he said, "Don't be silly. Where could I go?" It's like, "I'm just selling the Ford. It's no big deal." With that quietness, comes a way of being in the universe. It's what Heinlein calls grokking. It's like you are part, you are one with it all. So that the action that you perform as a separate entity arises out of the collective wisdom of the situation, rather than doing it in an angular way, cut off from everything. You start to trust your intuitive heart. Very interesting to start to live that way. You don't have to figure it all out. You start to trust that place. It doesn't mean you're anti-intellectual. Your mind is a beautiful tool. It's wonderful. It's just not a trap. And under those conditions, you start to become responsive to the world around you rather than reactive. Because your mind is part of law, it's all cause and effect, and it's all reactive. The minute you're in that awareness behind it, you're free, and you hear it all, and out of it comes that which is suitable to bring things back into harmony. Let me read you this one story from How Can I Help?, this wonderful book by Ram Dass and Paul Gorman. It really is good. It's got a lot of good stories in it, and this is one of them. It's a story about told to me by a friend of mine who's an Aikido master. His name is Terry Dobson. The train clanked and rattled through the suburbs of Tokyo on a drowsy spring afternoon. Our car was comparatively empty, a few housewives with their kids in tow, some old folks going shopping. I gazed absently at the drab houses and dusty hedgerows. At one station, the doors opened, and suddenly the afternoon quiet was shattered by a man bellowing violent, incomprehensible curses. The man staggered into our car. He wore labor's clothing, and he was big, drunk, and dirty. Screaming, he swung at a woman holding a baby. The blow sent her spinning into the laps of an elderly couple. It was a miracle that the baby was unharmed. Terrified, the couple jumped up and scrambled towards the other end of the car. The laborer aimed a kick at the retreating back of the old woman, but missed as she scuttled to safety. This so enraged the drunk that he grabbed this metal pole in the center of the car and tried to wrench it out of its stanchion. I could see that one of his hands was cut and bleeding. The train lurched ahead, the passengers frozen with fear. I stood up. I was young then, some 20 years ago, and in pretty good shape. I had been putting in a solid 8 hours of Aikido training nearly every day for the past 3 years. I liked to throw and grapple. I thought I was tough. The trouble was, my martial skill was untested in actual combat. As students of Aikido, we were not allowed to fight. Aikido, my teacher had said again and again, is the art of reconciliation. Whoever has the mind to fight has broken his connection with the universe. If you try to dominate people, you're already defeated. We study how to resolve conflict, not how to start it. I listened to his words. I tried hard. I even crossed the street to avoid the pinball punks who lounged around the train station. My forbearance exalted me. I felt both tough and holy. In my heart, however, I wanted an absolutely legitimate opportunity whereby I might save the innocent by destroying the guilty. This is it, I said to myself as I got to my feet. People are in danger. If I don't do something fast, somebody will probably get hurt. Seeing me stand up, the drunk recognized the chance to focus his rage. Aha! He roared. A foreigner! You need a lesson in Japanese manners! I held on lightly to the commuter strap overhead and gave him a slow look of disgust and dismissal. I planned to take this turkey apart, but he had to make the first move. I wanted him mad, so I pursed my lips and blew him an insolent kiss. All right, he hollered. You're gonna get a lesson. He gathered himself for a rush at me. A fraction of a second before he could move, someone shouted, Hey! It was ear-splitting. I remember the strangely joyous, lilting quality of it, as though you and a friend had been searching diligently for something and he had suddenly stumbled upon it. Hey! I wheeled to my left, the drunk spun to his right, we both stared down at a little old Japanese man. He must have been well into his 70s, this tiny gentleman, sitting there immaculate in his kimono. He took no notice of me, but beamed delightedly at the laborer, as though he had a most important, most welcome secret to share. Come here and talk to me, he motioned to the old man. The big man followed as if on a string. He planted his feet belligerently in front of the old gentleman and roared above the clacking wheels, Why the hell should I talk to you? The drunk now had his back to me. If his elbow moved so much as a millimeter, I'd drop him in his socks. The old man continued to beam at the laborer. What you been drinking? He asked, his eyes sparkling with interest. I've been drinking sake, and it's none of your business. Flecks of spittle spattered the old man. Oh, that's wonderful, the old man said. Absolutely wonderful. You see, I love sake, too. Every evening, me and my wife, she's 76, you know, we take our bottle of warm sake and we go out and sit on the wooden bench. We watch to see how our persimmon tree is doing. My grandfather planted that tree. We've been very concerned after those ice storms we had last winter. But you know, it's done better than we expected, especially when you consider the poor quality of the soil. And we take our sake even when it rains. He looked up at the laborer, his eyes twinkling. As he struggled to follow the old man's conversation, the drunk's face began to soften. His fists slowly unclenched. Yeah, he said. I love persimmons, too. His voice trailed off. Yes, said the old man, smiling, and I'm sure you have a wonderful wife. No, replied the laborer. My wife died. Very gently, swaying with the motion of the train, the big man began to sob. I don't got no wife. I don't got no home. I don't got no job. I'm so ashamed of myself. Tears rolled down his cheeks. A spasm of despair rippled through his body. Now it was my turn. Standing there in my well-scrubbed youthful innocence, my make this world safe for democracy righteousness, I suddenly felt dirtier than he was. Then the train arrived at my stop. As the door opened, I heard the old man cluck sympathetically. My, my, he said, that is a difficult predicament indeed. Sit down here and tell me about it. I turned my head for one last look. The laborer was sprawled on the seat, his head in the old man's lap. The old man was softly stroking the filthy, matted hair. As the train pulled away, I sat down on a bench. What I had wanted to do with muscle had been accomplished with love. I had just seen Aikido in combat. One more little brief thing, and then we're going to meditate together. As the mind quiets down, And there are a lot of practices to help you quiet the mind and to extricate yourself from identification with your thoughts. And you have more available to you that intuitive heart, that not the emotional quality, but it has a quality of presence and softness and feeling of the depth of love. It's like the quality of Christ's love, that quality. It's a very interesting thing what starts to happen in your life and how you deal with it. See, most of us grew up feeling like the ego is, in a way, got built on the idea that if we do the right things, we're lovable. I mean, we just grew up in an environment of conditional love. No matter how much our parents loved us, they still had an agenda. They had to socialize us. And they would tighten up if you shit on the living room floor. It's like they just tightened up a little bit, you know. And you learned what you didn't do to make it work. And you ended up with these feelings inside that... And you end up looking to find somebody who will feel safe for you to open your heart around. And most of the time, your heart is armored, as I said. And then somebody comes along, and there's some concatenation of stimuli, some configuration, and it releases that place in you, and you experience the quality of being back in your intuitive heart again. And you say, I am in love. And then, because you've been so starved for that, and that the other person had the key which opened your door to that place, you say, I am in love with you. The other way of saying it is the other person is a stimulus which is a releasing, which releases the releasing mechanism which allows you to be in the place of love. And you are in love. And then, because you're so addicted to this state, you want to connect. You want to possess your connection, like any addict. So where will you be Tuesday night and Friday night and for the rest of our lives? And you get jealous if the connection services anybody else, because you really want to feel that quality of being in love. Now, imagine if... through these practices, something starts to change so that the veil of your mind is thinner and you actually are experiencing that quality of love more. Now you walk down the street and you look at somebody and you experience that you are in love with them. The old model you have of deprivation says, I better collect this person. Because you're used to not having love. You've been so starved. So you say, let's nest. And you get feathers and twigs and drapes. And you create a nest and you get all cuddly. Do you love me? How much do you love me? Oh, I love your eggs. Ooh, ooh, everything. Oh, I love. Ooh, ooh, wonderful. And then you go to the store for some tofu and beer, and you're at the checkout counter, and you look into the eyes of the person at the checkout counter, and it happens again, because it's in you, but you still have the deprivation model, but you got one in the nest. So what do? Some of you have faced that. Ménage à trois, very complicated. It's the beginning of tremendous economic, political, psychological, social problems. And then what are you going to do? Never look at anybody else? Maybe what you're going to have to do, and what I found myself having to do, was give up my deprivation model. Give up the model that I was starved for love and that I needed to collect my lovers. And what has happened, and I can hardly understand it yet because it's still too new to me, is that everywhere I look, I'm beginning to see the Beloved. And I love people so much, I don't know what to do about it. And I have to realize there's nothing to do about it, which is very bizarre, to look at somebody and love them that much and not do anything. I mean, you would want to wave or collect a phone number or just hi or something like that. But you know, you walk into the bank to cash a check. You look at the teller, and the teller is just the perfection of God as teller. I mean, it's absolutely essence, and you just, but the minute you say, oh, Divine Mother, or you're beautiful, she presses the button. I mean, it's like, you learn there's nothing to do about it. As you stand back a little bit, you see the beauty of the manifestation, each one uniquely, even the stinkers are essence stinker. And your personality is saying no and cut it out and you can't do this and I won't allow this. And on the other part, you're totally in love with them. And then you begin to see the Beloved, the Guru, whatever you want to call that, everywhere you look. You see it all the time. There's a Kabir. Since the day when I met with my Lord, there has been no end to the sport of our love. I see with eyes open and smile and behold his beauty everywhere. I utter his name, and whatever I see, it reminds me of him. Whatever I do, it becomes his worship. Wherever I go, I move round him. All I achieve is his service. When I lie down, I lie prostrate at his feet. Whether I rise or sit down, I can never forget him. For the rhythm of his music beats in my ears. Quiet mind, open heart. Not standing anywhere, if you're burning out in the human heart, go up. But if you go up and you lose your humanity, you lost part of it. Sure, your heart's breaking, that's okay. You bear the unbearable, that's what it means to be free. It means free to embrace it all, free to push nothing away, but it's all empty. It's all play or dance or forms within forms. Sufferings, life, death, all of it. The hardest thing I have to do in these lectures is to integrate the incredible depth of the pain of suffering with the nature of the cosmic giggle. Most people can't handle getting those two things together. I talked about it in Hawaii a few weeks ago, and an article came out in the paper, the headline, which I loved. It said, "Ex-drug guru says life a cosmic giggle." Well, that's what happens to them. Oh, it's too beautiful, all of it, all of it, all of it, all of it. And when you're not busy being attached, you then fulfill, you listen and you hear your unique way of manifesting in the earth. You hear your uniqueness. I have an 89-year-old father. My job is to help take care of him and make sure he's happy and taken care of and safe and protected. That's my unique karma. I'm an American. I have something to do about that. I have to make sure that this representative democracy gets a fair shake and gets kept in control. I'm part of an ecosystem. I have to make a statement about nuclear proliferation. But if I do it out of fear and urgency, all I'm doing is increasing the fear, which is the root cause of the bomb in the first place. When I take care of Dad, when I protest against the bomb, when I do all the things that I do every day, meet the airplane stewardess, do all the stuff I do every day, all of it is the stuff I use to work on myself in order to increase the equanimity and to increase the compassion. It all is exercise. Your entire life is curriculum. Everything you've got right on your plate is where the stuff for your enlightenment is. It's breathtaking when you stand back and see the beauty of that design. And that includes all of it, death and sickness and dying and AIDS and all of it.